In this lesson, we're going to focus on failover. We're going to take a look at two types of failover. Active-active, which means you have multiple contexts in your firewall, and active standby, which means you're running single mode. And there's no other options for it besides those two, by the way. So if you're in multiple contexts, you're running active-active. And if you're running in single mode, it's active standby. Some of the hardware requirements and software requirements to make this work is that you have to have two identical twins. Now, their serial numbers don't have to be identical, and the flash doesn't have to be identical, but you should make sure that flash has enough room on both of the devices to hold the entire config. But as far as interfaces, memory, if there's any IPS modules, for example, that would all have to be simulated or identical on both sides. The LAN-based failover link itself is going to be used to replicate configuration changes. You're on the active firewall and you make a change and poof, that change shows up on the secondary. There's also a stateful link that you can use if you want to replicate the session, the stateful database on the ASA. If you want to replicate that real time, you can do that on a stateful link. You can use the LAN-based failover link and the stateful link. That can be the same physical interface if you want. But you can also carve it out and have it to be two separate interfaces. So here's the deal. With active standby, one device is going to be acting as the real ASA moving all the traffic, and the other ASA is going to be sitting there hoping that the other one doesn't fail. But if it does, it'll go ahead and take over and start and assume the role of forwarding traffic on behalf of the ASA as a team. So active standby, you pay for two, one does the work. With active-active, you still pay for two firewalls, but based on individual contexts, you can have one context active on physical firewall 1 and a different context active on physical firewall 2. And from that perspective, there is some measure of manual hard-coded load balancing in a non-failed condition. I have learned through experience that it makes a lot of sense to read through the entire lab before you actually start working on it. I don't mean read it like a novel and take a lot of time, but certainly peruse the entire thing. Why is that? Because if I know later in a task that I'm going to be doing failover, when I'm on the firewalls for the first time, I can do a lot of things that I don't have to come back for. For example, assigning the standby addresses. Instead of doing an IP address with the primary address only and then having to go back and redo them with the standby addresses, I can get that in one fell swoop if I read through my config early. Also, if you have failover and you have two firewalls, when you're carving out your VLANs for ASA1, make sure you carve out your VLANs on the switch for ASA2 because the switch support needs to be identical. If you're trunking to E00 on ASA1, make sure you trunk to E00 on ASA2. Everything needs to be identical from a layer 1 and layer 2 perspective to support these firewalls. So exactly what do we need to configure? Well, besides standby addresses, which go after the primary address with the keyword standby, let's focus on the primary firewall first. A long time ago, there was this serial cable on the PICs. It looked like a joystick connector on the back of your PICs. There's no serial cable. Now it's all LAN-based failover. So we have to tell the ASA in the configuration whether you're the primary or whether you're the secondary. And how that's done is with the failover LAN unit primary command. So we're just going to focus on the primary just for a moment. So once you specify failover LAN unit primary, this guy knows, hey, I'm King Kong. I'm the active guy. I'm supposed to be active, that is, assuming everything's working. You're also going to specify what the failover LAN interface is. So from global configuration mode, type in failover LAN interface space and then E00 or E01 or E02. Usually it's going to be a physical interface, but it certainly could be a sub interface if that's what's asked of you in the lab environment. Once you've specified your failover interface, it gives you a little pop-up saying, or a little message saying, all the normal config has been whacked off of that interface. That's fine. Make sure, however, that interface you're using for LAN-based failover, make sure you've gone into it and you've done a no shut. If that interface is not physically not shut down, you're not going to get anywhere with LAN-based failover. So once you've no shut it, you've identified it, you're now going to assign an IP address to that interface. We don't assign the IP address to the failover LAN interface in interface configuration mode. This is like a carryover from how it used to be with version 6 of the PICs from many, many years ago. we're going to use the command in configuration mode, failover interface IP, and then you name your failover interface, and then you specify the IP address and mask you're going to use, the keyword standby, and then the standby IP address, which, of course, would be in the same subnet as your primary address. So whoever becomes active is going to assume the system IP addresses. Whoever is acting as standby is going to assume these secondary IP addresses. If you want to kick it up a notch and add stateful failover as well, very simple. You simply say failover link and then name it and then specify your interface, E0/2 or E0/3. You can also use the management interface, M00. That would be a valid option for failover if you wanted to use that. And that will give you the option of stateful replication of your stateful database on the ASA from the primary to the standby, from the active to the standby. If you did use a completely separate interface for the stateful failover, you'd also assign an IP address for that interface. Most of the time, it's going to be one interface for land-based failover and stateful, so you've already assigned an IP address. However, if you're using a second physical interface for the stateful failover, you'd use the failover interface IP address command again to assign a unique IP address for primary and secondary for that stateful link itself. Once that's done, and make sure also, this is one thing that a lot of people forget, make sure that you've carved out on the switch for your failover interface or interfaces if you're doing stateful on a separate one, make sure you put them in the correct VLAN. It's going to be an access port on the switch unless you're doing your replication on a sub-interface, which is possible. But make sure the switch infrastructure is solid for that. Once you've verified your layer 2 is good for your failover interface, you can then issue the command failover and press enter. And here, my friends, is where you just want to stop, take a deep breath, and you should get some console messages that come up. It should say failover. There should be a failover message, and it should say looking for mate. Looking for active mate. And it should, after about 45 or so seconds, say active mate not found, taking on the active role. And then it will go active. And that takes literally 45 seconds to a minute to happen. And I would wait for those console messages to come up. Don't rush off to your secondary firewall and start configuring, because I'll tell you what has happened and can happen. Not that I'm going to put it in your mind that it's going to happen, but if you don't make sure your primary is up and happy, I had someone got ahead of the game. They brought up their secondary firewall, configured it perfectly. There was a link issue because the VLANs weren't carved out right. The secondary came up first. It came up because it couldn't find the primary. It assumed the role of active, and you know what the primary firewall did when it finally went active and found the secondary that was active? It said, oh, you're active. And it replicated the configs the wrong way. And he lost all of his configs from the secondary, basically wiped everything out on the primary. So please don't make that mistake. So let's take a look at the secondary unit. Once you do a show fail and it shows that it's active and it can't see the other host, then you can go to the secondary unit. And on the secondary unit, it's the identical commands. Make sure you do a no shut on your land fail interface. Make sure the switch is supporting that port correctly with the correct VLAN. Make sure you've given time for spanning tree to figure out it's okay to have forward traffic on that port. So maybe give it a few seconds. Although ASAs keep link up even if the interface is administratively down, so that may not be a problem. And then you do issue the exact same commands on the secondary firewall that you did on the first one, with one exception, and it's huge. If you're a copy and paster, please pay attention. The biggest difference is that you're going to say failover LAN unit secondary. And once you've done that, you do a show run fail, verify your config is solid, then you can run the failover command. So you type in failover, you sit back on this secondary firewall, and it should say looking for active mate, and it should find it within 10 seconds. If 20 or 30 seconds goes by and it hasn't found the active mate, what you get to do is type in no failover, and then troubleshoot your layer 2 connectivity. Make sure that everything is correct between those two firewalls. If it doesn't find it immediately, stop the failover process and check the basics. But it should find it, found active mate, replicating from active mate, and then your host name is going to change. So it's going to replicate to the host name of the primary firewall. Please make sure in the future when you go back to those devices, you're configuring only on the active firewall. Over on the active firewall, if you do a write mem, that should replicate a write mem on the secondary firewall, and both will then have their config saved to flash in the event of a reload of either one. They're both ready to go ahead and take over. So failover, active standby. That's what we've covered just now. What I'd like to cover next is active-active, which implies we're using multiple contexts. So if they ask you to do active standby, Cisco in their documentation calls active standby a possibility even on multiple context firewalls if you have ASA1 active for all the contexts and ASA2 physically sitting there saying, I'm not active for any of them. That's kind of splitting hairs. If you're doing multiple contexts, you're going to have to set up as if you're doing active-active failover. So let's take a look at that next. Okay, so here's the great news for active-active failover. All the configuration that we just did for active standby, it all still applies. Every ounce of it is exactly the same, except for the fact that we are going to be doing all the config in the system execution space on the firewalls. So in active-active, we have multiple contexts. You have your primary firewall. You have your secondary firewall. Those labels do not change. One's always going to be primary. The other's always going to be secondary. Active-active is going to have one primary and one standby, exactly the same. So the commands such as in system context space, failover LAN unit primary, still valid. Failover LAN interface, still valid. Failover interface IP, still valid. 98% of all the failover configuration you do in active-active and multiple context failover is done in the system execution space. There's one little caveat, and I'll cover that at the end. So all the basics are the same. What is added to active-active failover that we need to be aware of? Let's take a look at that right now. The addition for active-active failover is that in the system context, in the system space, we are going to create two failover groups. Failover group one, and that's the actual syntax to create it, and failover group two, which is the syntax to create that one. Inside of failover group one, when you type it, you're putting group configuration mode, and you're going to specify one of two keywords, primary or secondary. So if I said failover group one primary, I exit out, go to failover group two secondary, then any contexts that are assigned to failover group one are going to be active on the primary firewall. Any contexts assigned to failover group two are going to be active on the secondary firewall. That's what that means. So once you've created these two failover groups, you then go into your context configuration, still in the system execution space on your multiple context firewall. You type in context spaced, context one, enter, and you'd say join-failover-group(1). That means that group, context one, is going to be active on the primary firewall. If we had a second context, context two, again, still in the system space, we type in context spaced, context two, enter, and we type in join-failover-group(2), enter. That context, context two, would then be active on the secondary firewall. Why? Because we said failover group two a few commands earlier is going to be managed and held active by the secondary firewall. And that's the splitting we can do for effective load balancing. Load balancing in the sense that the primary firewall will be active for context one and the secondary firewall will be active for context two. And here's another tip regarding points in the ASA. If I was given a task that asked me to make sure that ASA 1 is active for context 1 and ASA 2 is active for context 2, that sounds pretty easy. We just create our failover groups, assign our context to those groups, and we're done. What happens if you power off ASA 2 and you power it back on? What happens by default is that when you power off ASA 2, context 2, which it managed, is no longer going to be managed by ASA 2. When ASA 1 gets the coup message saying, ASA 2 is saying, I'm leaving, goodbye, ASA1 isn't going to wait for failures. It's actually going to take over, and now it's going to be active for context one and context two. When ASA2 comes back up, it's not going to say, hey, I was told that I'm supposed to manage context two. Can I have it, please, by default? It just says, hey, ASA1, I see that you're managing context one and context two. Thank you very much. I'll just sit here in case something fails. That's the default behavior, which would cost points if you were asked to make sure that ASA1 managed context one and ASA2 managed context two. To fix that, what you would do inside of your failover groups in the system context space, you'd simply type in failover group one, for example, and you type in preempt. The preempt command says, hey, if I'm up and running, I want that context and go active for it. So you could very safely put preempt with a delay. The delay simply says how many seconds. Let's say ASA booted up and it said preempt space 300. It would wait 300 seconds and then it would ask for control of that context again. So you could put 10 seconds or 15 seconds. It doesn't really matter. I usually give it a little buffer, like 60 seconds or maybe a couple minutes, because when systems first boot up, sometimes they're not really happy. Like, oh, I just woke up. What's going on? And maybe there's something that hasn't initialized yet. I'd like to give it a few seconds to completely stabilize. So preempt space and a number like 10, 15, 30 seconds would be a great idea if you want to get points based on a task that asks you to make sure ASA1 is active for context 1 and ASA2 is active for context 2. In multiple context mode with failover, if you did configure a stateful failover link, which is great, that means stateful information is replicated. So telnet sessions, SSH sessions, other TCPBA sessions are all going to basically survive, with the exception of HTTP. Cisco decided that that's the primary traffic going through the firewalls. It would be HTTP in many cases, and the ASAs by default don't bother replicating the HTTP stateful information. If you want each of your contexts to replicate that information, you can use in the failover group subinterface configuration, you can specify replication space HTTP, enter for both contexts, and that will replicate that for you. When you do a show fail, it will show you all of that information, including the stateful information for any sessions that are currently in progress. I mentioned that 99% of all the failover configuration is done from the system space in multiple context mode, and that's true. So here's the exception that you should be aware of. If I want to include, let's say I have context one, so I go into context one, and that's coming up, by the way, in our couple chapters away with multiple virtual firewalls. But if I want to go to context two, I do a change to context two, and poof, I'm in that logical firewall now. If I want to include my inside interface or not include my inside interface, I can have that personal choice. System-wide, the administrator is controlling failover for the physical boxes. But if I want to tell my virtual context that I don't want to monitor the inside interface or the DMZ interface for whatever reason, I could say no, monitor-interface DMZ. And that would simply tell my virtual firewall, it's like sending a message up to the system space saying, hey, by the way, this one interface you allocated to me, I don't want it monitored for the purposes of failover. So if it fails, just let it go and don't trigger a failover on the whole box because of it. If you have sub-interfaces, my observation has been that sub-interfaces by default don't get monitored with failover. So if you had an inside interface that was a sub-interface that had been allocated to a context and you wanted to include it, you'd say inside that context, change to context one, monitor-interface, space inside. And the show failover will show you exactly what's going on. It'll show you which firewall is active for which context and which interfaces are being monitored or not monitored. So if you're trying to resemble the output of a show fail and there's interfaces that are monitored or not monitored, that is the command that you'd use to turn on and off that switch. Some other nerd knobs that we can twist and tweak is specifying the poll time for the interface, poll time for unit back and forth between the two devices. And it looks like, from the surface, that we can go like from 1 second to 15 seconds. However, if we specify poll time interface and use the keyword msec, we can actually specify poll times that are less than a second. So if you said pull time, interface, msec for milliseconds, 500, which is half of a second. You could do that and get a pull interval that's as small as you want. In a production environment, the faster you can fail over, the better. But you also have the issue of if there's a slight hiccup or a hitch that lasts for 1 or 2 seconds, do you want that to trigger a failover of the entire box? Again, that choice is up to you, but I wanted to make sure you had the tools to tweak any parameters they give you or ask you about with failover. The one item I did not talk about, which deserves speaking about a little bit, is the password. If you want to configure encryption, that's what they call it, between your two failover devices, you can simply by specifying a password as part of your failover configuration. And the syntax is failover space key space and then the string that you'd like to use, and make sure that matches on your primary and your secondary ASA. One other item that I'm just reviewing my notes on, and I don't see it in the online doc, is failover LAN enable. It's quite possible that is on by default now that there's no serial interfaces on the ASA, but that certainly couldn't hurt as well. Failover LAN enable to enable LAN-based failover. If it is a default or if it's not needed, it certainly will not hurt your failover configuration. You know, there's one other feature I want to share with you that is not likely to come up, but boy, if it did, you'd want to know about this. And that has to do with asymmetrical routing. You know, the state table that the ASA builds, a wonderful thing. However, it gets its knickers in a bind if there's traffic that goes out one way and then the return traffic comes in a different way, asymmetrical routing. That could happen if you have two contexts. You know, we have stateful failover between two devices. Traffic goes out through context one, through firewall one, and the return traffic comes back through context two. If you have stateful failover, you can enable a feature called ASR group. And what you would do is go to each of the interfaces on each of the contexts. So go into context one, go into interface inside, for example, and say ASR group one. If you did that, ASR group one or ASR group two, as long as you have the numbers that match, if there's a packet that comes back and the firewall has no stateful information for it, it will check the stateful replication of the failover. If it sees that the other firewall should have this traffic, it rewrites the packet and shoots it over to the other firewall. So again, we can cross our fingers, hope that doesn't happen to us in the lab. However, if it does, if there's some weird situation where you trace a packet and says, oh, it's coming down through this context and it's going back through the other context, and maybe that's why it's failing, use the ASR-group command in each of the interfaces using the same group number. And if it's an asymmetrical routing issue that's causing you grief with that, with the stateful failover, this command could be a lifesaver. So how do we test and verify that this is all working? Well, when you're done, whether it's active or active standby failover, you should be able to do a show fail, press enter, and look at the output. The output's a lot more simple on active standby because it says I'm the primary, I'm currently active, the other guy's secondary, he's currently standby. And with active, there's going to be more information. It's going to show you the perspective from the current firewall, a perspective from the other firewall, what interfaces are being monitored. But you know what? If you really want to know if it's working, there's only one way to really tell. And that is to save your configs. If you are in active failover, really super important. In the system space, you'd want to do a write space mem space all. That saves the system execution space, and it does a write mem for each of the contexts on your firewall. So if you do that on your primary firewall, that will be replicated to the secondary firewall, and then everything will be saved or should be saved. So once it's all saved, you could power off one of your firewalls and bring it back up and see if the other firewall carries the traffic through as you thought it should. Now, active or active standby failover should take less than about 15 to 20 minutes to configure from soup to dessert. If you are fuzzy with failover, meaning you've done it maybe a few times, not really comfortable that you could hammer it in, you're hoping you don't get it, Murphy's Law says you probably will get it if you're not ready for it. The best way to prepare to not get failover in the lab is simply to practice it, be comfortable with it, and know it cold. and then it's likely you won't get it, Murphy's Law. Either way, you'll be a better technician, and failover on the ASA is absolutely something that's done in most corporate environments that have ASAs. So I hope you enjoyed this section on failover. Our next chapter, which is exciting, is on the Layer 2 transparent firewall, going into transparent mode with the ASA. I'll see you then.